Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to The Plays the Thing. This is Tim McIntosh, and I am today not with Sarah Jane, and I am not with Heidi because we have a special guest joining us today. I'm going to tell you about this special guest, but just to remind you, we are between Acts 3 and Acts 4 of The Merchant of Venice, and I have brought on my friend, Judith Sparky Roberts. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my relationship with, I'm going to just call her Sparky. That's what I've always called her. I'm going to tell you about how I know Sparky, but I'm going to first, I really want to give you her, a little bit about her resume, because listeners, you're going to be very impressed. So Sparky did her graduate work in theater at Brandeis University under the great American Shakespearean actor, Morris Karnofsky. And she has since then been always been closely acquainted with William Shakespeare. She is the reason why I first acted in a Shakespeare scene, which we'll talk about on the air in a little bit. She has directed several Shakespeare plays. She has directed Shakespeare showcases with scenes. I don't know how many scenes from Shakespeare she has directed. Her MFA thesis project took place in Boston. She trained a theater troupe there doing outdoor public performances, and she continued that practice when she moved to Oregon throughout the 1970s while she taught at the University of Oregon. When she was the theater arts instructor at Lane Community College, where she taught until 2014. Sparky has performed for Johnny Carson. She was part of the Johnny Carson's, she can clarify it for me, kind of like his memorable replay. She was one of those segments that was highlighted by him. She played Queen Margaret in Richard III and also has directed full-length versions of The Taming of the Shrew and Much Ado About Nothing. And I am delighted to welcome to the podcast, Judith Sparky Roberts. Hey, Sparky, thanks so much for being on the show. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm doing well considering we breathed smoke for a whole week down here in Oregon.
Yeah. And my understanding is that you got some rain and that things have kind of settled down a little bit. Is that true?
Things have settled down over the massive destruction that we had. Fortunately not right in our midst, but very nearby. But
yeah,
you know, it's just the way of the world.
I'm so sorry that got so so close, but I'm glad that you're okay.
Well, I had to clear my throat in order to talk to you today
and drink a full glass of water. Okay, Sparky, I'm just going to tell everybody, I think you'll remember this. I met you because you and I were cast together in a play. You played my mother-in-law in a play called Rabbit Hole.
Right.
And I did not know any, that was the first play I had ever been in, and I didn't know anything about acting. And I remember we had one of our friends, Michelle Nordello, was playing my sister-in-law. And Michelle and I, her character and my character, get in an argument about halfway through the play. And I remember during rehearsals, I would come backstage after our scene, and I didn't know who you were. I just knew that you were a good actor, but I didn't know anything about your theater background. I didn't know that you were a pro. And I would walk backstage, and she said, and you would say, "Well, she won that fight." I said, "What do you mean? What do you mean she won that fight?" And you said, "She was louder than you. She was more aggressive than you. She was clearer in her words than you. She won the fight." And I was like, "No, she didn't. She did not win the fight. I won the fight because I had the better lines, you know." And you went after me. And I was so grateful. Like, at some point I figured out, oh, Sparky's a pro. I'm dealing with a pro here. And I learned so much from you about acting. And later,
By being that rude.
I loved it. I loved it because I wanted to be better. It wasn't, to me, it wasn't rude at all. It was kind of like, "Hey, buddy, you got to step your game up. If you're going to be up on stage, you got to step your game up."
I don't remember that.
I remember it so vividly. It was wonderful. Sparky, I want to talk to you about Merchant of Venice among a whole host of other things. First, I want to ask you about your experience with the play. Part of the reason that I wanted to bring you on the show is because you come from a Jewish background. One of the first questions that we discussed in Act One of Merchant was, is the play anti-Semitic? Was Shakespeare perhaps anti-Semitic? But before we get to that question, tell me just about your experience with the play. Have you directed the play? Have you directed scenes from the play? What's your experience with it?
Well, I've directed the Portia and Nerissa scene countless times. Mm. Well, that and the scenes on the Rialto, mm-hmm. Especially the I Am a Jew sequence.
3-1. We talked about that last week. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And with Tubal. The other scenes on the Rialto, the mm-hmm. Antonio Shylock, all of those scenes. Let me see if there are any others I have actually directed. Probably, but I can't remember. Those are the
right.
The more popular ones. And a young woman in one of my classes who was half Jewish chose as her first monologues of her entire life to do Shylock
really?
And Antonio. She wanted to do both halves of their encounter on the Rialto, which I thought was a really brave choice for a novice actor to do that. And the thing was, she could really put heart and soul into it, and she knew that she could. She was lured by the words. And she carried it off, you know, for a beginning actor. She carried it off. It's amazing how Shakespeare brings out these things in people. The scene on the Rialto was the one that she was attracted to rather than the one in the bedroom with Portia and Nerissa.
Now, you've been to the Rialto in Venice. Do you remember what you saw? I mean, when you saw the Rialto, were you thinking in the back of your head about The Merchant of Venice, the play by William Shakespeare?
Not at that time, no. It was in the 80s, I guess, that I went there, or early in this century. And I just was fascinated. But in rereading the play, a lot of memories of the place came back. And the context of the play is always the present in the play. So it brought it back. It brought the play into kind of a new relief or significance for me. And especially now when there's so much focus on differences among people and on the castigation of a whole group of people, or naming groups of people and being angry about groups of people and blaming groups for things.
Yeah.
So this is so present in the play, and it's there's a lot that's relevant. Also, when Merchant was presented, a plague, the bubonic plague, had been there for the year before, and the quarantine ended right before this play was first
produced. I forgot about that. I can't believe that I forgot about that. That yeah,
it was
because they shut the theaters down in London for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, shut the theaters down. So this was like, you know, an opening to, so there's a relevance there.
Right.
And the other part of the other relevance is this animosity that has kind of reared its ugly head.
Yeah.
In this period of time, where groups are at each other's throat to try to, I guess, compensate for feeling the pull of worldly catastrophic influences.
Yeah.
So you gotta listen, you got to blame somebody.
Yes.
Or you'd like to.
Not right.
You'd like to. People tend to. They want to make things right. And how do you do that? You excise what it is you hate or that's standing in the way and name it something. And
you find a scapegoat.
You find a scapegoat. And yeah, so in Venice was different from the rest of Europe. For one thing, England had expelled all Jews in, I think it was 1390 or something.
Okay.
Three centuries before, they were gone.
Yeah.
There weren't Jews in London when Shakespeare lived there. And the one notable Jewish figure in life in London when he was writing was a man named Dr. Lopez, who was the physician to Queen Elizabeth. And Dr. Lopez, it's not confirmed that he was Jewish. He is thought to be Jewish. He would have been of the Sephardic heritage, which is Spanish. And somebody trumped up some charges against him, and he was executed in a horrible manner. I mean, he was, you know, drawn and quartered.
And this was in Shakespeare's lifetime.
And he may have seen it.
Oh, really? He might have seen it.
This is the theory. And no one knows, you know, how he would have felt about that. I mean, things like that went on back then. But this was because the man was thought to be, or was, a Jew.
Yeah.
He was highly respected. I mean, you know, revered.
He's the doctor to the
Doctor of the Queen Elizabeth, and you know, somebody didn't like him, and I mean, I don't remember what the charges were, but
right,
that was it for him.
Right.
But to your point about Jews being aliens, yes, I agree with you. Probably the fact that Shylock is called the Jew,
mm-hmm.
He doesn't even really mostly have a name in the play. He's called Jew,
mm-hmm.
or he's referred to as the Jew. Now, what this suggests is that nobody really knew the guy. He was already an angry figure. He
yeah.
His speech is scratchy, repetitive. He doesn't speak the way the other people do. And
let him look to his bond. He repeats in three, we talked last week about how he repeats himself. Let him look to his bond, talking about Antonio. Let him look to his bond. And it's so unlike the other characters, and so unlike Shakespeare in so many ways, his almost, repetitiveness.
Yeah, he almost has incantations in his speeches because he revisits these phrases over and over, you know. And
yeah.
that kind of is a sensibility that is consistent with Jewish, I guess you'd say, worship. The repetition of things and kind of easing into a subject by reconsidering the words. There's a great tradition in Judaism of talk.
Yeah.
Of debate.
Yeah.
And the ideal, really, of knowledge and discovery and sharing knowledge is a kind of debate. The discussion is often referred to that way. And some of the most revered rabbinical figures are referred to as having argued into the night or argued all night. And so this is a style that is endemic to Judaism as a religious pursuit, you might say, but it's still alien in this play, but it's interesting to me how Shakespeare actually somehow knew or exploited that particular custom.
Sparky, I've got to tell you a story real quick about a couple of people that I think you know. I'll use their names on the air. I think it's fine. Paul Roden, a friend of ours, a really wonderful actor from Eugene, Oregon. And Darlene, his wife, got married, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that. Paul is Jewish. Darlene is an evangelical Christian. And Darlene would attend synagogue with Paul sometimes. And she told me about the first time that she went to synagogue with Paul. And she said, so the rabbi reads from Torah, and then he explicates the text, and then he sits down, and they just argued for an hour. The synagogue, the attendees and the rabbi just argued for an hour. And she was kind of shocked, and really, she also kind of loved it. I said, sounds kind of terrific. And she loved it also. But then she said, 6 months later, I was like, so how's synagogue going? She's like, oh, the argument is just so wearying. They just argue so much.
Now, personally, I haven't really experienced it.
Really? Really?
But I know it's a tradition.
Yeah. When you see this play, I'm sorry to cut you off. When you see this play.
Okay. We mentioned the Rialto, but we're going to go back to that later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're an audience member or you're directing a scene. Does the charge that the play is anti-Semitic or that Shakespeare is anti-Semitic, what do you think about that?
Well, there's a range of considerations here. First of all, the culture was anti-Semitic. And not because they knew anything about Jews. They didn't. Jews have been gone for ages. It was still just a scapegoat. For whatever troubles, yeah. And there was not only I think the hatred was partly born of perhaps envy at Jews' success in business and intellectual achievements, perhaps. And even maybe the people-ness or the adhesion of the people, despite the diaspora. They were all scattered, and yet they still feel a sense of being a nation, as it were. They're not a race. They're an ethnic people. And also Christians, I don't know about in the play, but perhaps have an antipathy to their past as Jews. Not their personal past. So that Christianity wouldn't exist without the Jew called Jesus.
Right.
And yes, there have been all these reasons for hating Jews who were thought to be his persecutors or his killers.
Right.
But a lot of stories rose up to create the, I guess you'd call it, sense of not only difference, but what's superior.
Yeah.
Somehow people who in different religions are righteous and self-righteous. So if you don't believe what we believe, your beliefs are bad.
Yeah.
And that's still true.
No, it hasn't changed.
Why we haven't gotten over that, I don't know. And why Christians can't just embrace the Old Testament and Jewish allegory and stories as their own and enjoy that, you know, and add the Second Testament to it. I've never been sure.
Yeah.
But they seem to have to bury or ignore or banish the past, as it were.
Right.
And the behaviors are different, you know, culturally. I mean, So it was interesting to me in seeing the interpretations by Patrick Stewart and David Suchet.
Right.
They both made Shylock intensely unsympathetic. Mm. I'm going to say that again. Both Pat and Dave made Shylock intensely unsympathetic. And both readings were a bit fractured.
Yeah.
Jerky changes. Overall, I liked Suchet's interpretation better. I could read him a bit better. But Stewart seemed a little too loony. And I would get real tired of watching that for a whole play. And that,
right.
But it definitely makes Shylock feel alien. And I think he wanted to create that impression. But certain words and phrases are sloughed as if the spectator already knows the text. So you can go ahead and mumble it or
right.
elide over the words so that we don't even really hear. We Americans revel in the language in our own way, American actors. And it's different. And maybe
right.
more precious with the language. But in any case, no critic disputes that the language in Merchant of Venice is as lyrical as music. It is music. And the music, for me, becomes an important part of the delivery, the intonation, the rhythm, the meaning, and the sound. I feel that the harshness and brokenness that's written into Shylock doesn't need overacting. What it needs is
yeah.
a good interpreter, a good sounder of the sounds. So that's how I would do it differently. Now, or Shylock anyway.
You would play the musicality of his lines. Yeah.
Now, I rewatched Al Pacino's version, which for the first half was really electric. And then I felt that the movie itself flagged after that. Mm. But up until then, what I liked was a quality that Al Pacino had that comes from A, being Italian, and B, being raised in New York, where the Italians and Jews mix in this mercantile atmosphere. Huh. And he would have heard them doing business all his life.
Yeah.
Something in his speech captures those cadences, those intonations, what sounds odd in Venice would be the way it sounds in New York City. And we are speaking English, but he did everything he could to fight his own New York accent. And what he had was a certain flavor that overlaps those two cultures. And I found that very effective up until the movie flagged. So the interpretations differ. I found Suchet was, because he is Jewish, had more of the personal investment.
Oh.
Stewart is a very fine actor. I don't fault him at all. He's just as valid in his own way. And you can see from John Barton's workshops in general, and this one in particular, every actor has his or her own take on the part. And that's the beauty of it.
Yes.
Going to play it the same as somebody else, or else why right. would you even do it?
Right.
So.
Hey, I want to, while we're talking about the musicality of language, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but.
No.
I just don't want to lose the story that you told me off the air about one of your students. I think it was at Lane. Maybe it was at the University of Oregon, was dyslexic and had relatively little acquaintance with Shakespeare or acting Shakespeare. But something happened when this person was acting with you. Do you remember this story? Can you tell the story?
When I was teaching at college, I was kind of bowled over by each class, each term, at least one person would show up who had some difficult relationship with language. And it was often the people with the most severe afflictions, like speech defect or reading dyslexic dyslexia, who attached themselves to Shakespeare. And for a while, you know, I was asking people, I'd say, well, why do you want to do this? I mean, you could do a regular American play and be speaking language more like you speak. I mean, this is very demanding, even for professional actors. Well, there was just no question. There was no answer. There was no question. They just, that's it. You know, they had fastened on Shakespeare as a way out of their feelings about speech. And man, they pursued it with such intensity and dedication and vigor.
Really?
One of them, you know him, is still acting every chance he gets. He's a force on stage. He's phenomenal. And I think there are a lot of actors you don't know this about.
You told me about the actor that we're not naming, and I was stunned that he was dyslexic. I had no idea, because I had seen him perform many times, and you told me, I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it.
A lot of rehearsal and listening to it. And I think that listening to it, maybe that's the thing, Tim.
Maybe.
That hearing it makes it more able to be articulated, you know, and delivered, hearing it. And once you get the rhythms and the music, then it's different than just looking at marks on a page, which to some dyslexic people make no sense at all.
And I wonder also, I'm talking out of my depth here, but I wonder if performing Shakespeare is not just communicating information because of the musicality of the language. I have wondered if that sort of striking that musical tone in a way kind of bypasses that internal editor that perhaps some dyslexic people have that makes them think too much about the text or too much about the words. Again, this is a non-medical, unprofessional.
Once you've got it internalized, it is no longer words on a page.
Right.
And that's the great relief of the whole thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And then it becomes like singing.
Yeah.
And of course, interacting with the other characters, that adds the juice.
Yeah.
Impetus for everything that you're saying. But it is very much like singing, especially if it's the Shakespearean style that's written in verse, because it is all parsed out in beat, meter. And once you hear the meter, you know when you've gone wrong because you left out a word and it doesn't go, you know, it doesn't scan. And so scansion, I think, is a big key to memorizing it and delivering it and not forgetting it.
I remember when I first started working with you on a Shakespeare scene, Mary Buss and I, Mary was played my wife in the play that I mentioned at the top of the show, Rabbit Hole.
Oh.
And she and I did Measure for Measure. Oh gosh, I think it's 3-5 maybe. She plays my sister, Isabella, and I am her brother. And she's telling me that I've got to die unless she sleeps with the governor. And so anyway, I remember working on the scene at your house, and Mary and I are up there. And I remember I dropped a little bitty word, and you were not looking at the text, and you said, nope, you dropped something there. And I was like, and I thought, how in the world did she know that I dropped like one little word? It was an article or like some little tiny preposition. And I thought, how did you do it? And it's because your ear, because of your extraordinary experience, has trained itself to hear that when one syllable is missing from a line, you pick up on it. It doesn't scan. That was remarkable.
Well, it's written there on the, you know, it's in the rhythm. It's all there. He's pretty adept at writing in verse. Is that what, was that a Shakespeare scene we were doing?
Yeah, it was. It was the Measure for Measure scene we were doing.
Oh, God, what a great scene. Was that
what a great scene.
In the, was that the one in the Antonio scene, or is that the...
Yes.
No, that was the one in the prison?
It's the one in the prison. It's after Antonio. It's
Isabella. And what's his
name? I to die and go we know not where, to lie in cold obstruction and to rot. This sensible warm ocean. It's such a great scene. It's so beautiful.
And it's
that was the first one.
In you. You see how it's still in you?
I know.
Well,
I know.
You heard somebody do that speech, you would know instantly they left out a word, just as if
it's true.
Song.
You know, that's a great point. That's true. That's a really great point.
Well, why was that note there and you didn't have a lyric where it
went? Yeah, that's right. Right. Like a lyric was misplaced.
But the other thing is that singing it like that, I always encourage students to sing their parts.
Mm.
Like I say to them, okay, you've got this delicious, juicy monologue.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you take it home, or I'll have them do it in rehearsal with me and sing it. And, you know, there's always this hesitation. I'll say, well, what music do you like?
Uh-huh.
How about something in bluegrass or how about something rock and roll or something folky or whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know, just so you can free your voice, get the rhythm in there, belt it out, find the ways you can navigate through the thoughts and
yes.
raise your voice and lower your voice and make one syllable longer than the other. And just to really mess around with it,
uh-huh.
pull it apart and then put it back together the way it goes. Give it some of those beautiful intonations you found while you were singing, because none of them is off base. It's all there to own with your own voice and your own mouth. It takes a lot of mouth, as you know.
Mm-hmm, it does.
It takes a lot of mouth. That's what I tell people. We do all those vocal exercises and also physical and facial exercises.
Yes.
Just to make the mouth able to say those words. And my students have an extra torture, which I learned in graduate school from a now deceased person who I couldn't stand at the time because she was such a taskmaster. But now, I am so thankful to her. She taught me cork work, which is not really taught widely anymore.
Yeah, tell us about cork work, because you taught me how to do it, and I hated it at the beginning, and now I do. Like, if I've got a speaking part, and especially if it's Shakespeare, I do cork work. So tell us what it is.
Maybe at the end I could just show something. The cork has to be cork, not plastic cork.
Mm.
You cut off about a fourth of it, and the rest of it sticks in your mouth upright.
From a wine bottle.
From a wine bottle. And you can collect them. They're easy to get. You only need one, but some people have two in case one breaks, in case they chew it up. Unless you have a jaw problem or you're just getting used to the idea, where you could use it the short way, the cylinder sideways, then you put the cylinder upright in between the front teeth. And there's a lot of preparation that I do to get ready for cork work. I don't have people just stick a cork in their mouth and do this, because if you're not ready, you can hurt yourself. You hurt your mm-hmm. jaw. You can hurt your jaw. But getting the breath going, getting the posture of, you know, delivering lines and so on, getting the breath even and controlled and able to be used for volume or whatever. Then you speak without trying to make any sense.
Mm.
And speak your lines. But you could also speak the lines backward, because what's most important is not getting through the line or making sense, but getting the most out of every word and phrase. So you overuse your face and your mouth. You're breathing really well so that your air is useful. And you're just saying a word at a time or two words at a time. But one of the rules or principles is that if it's not clear to your ear, you say it again and again and again until you get it clear, which in itself is an exercise. So mostly the STs are going to be really difficult and slushy. The S's are going to start out really slushy. But if you find the right position for your tongue in your mouth around that cork.
Yes.
Sometimes you have to stick the tongue up the cork. I mean, up the back of the cork. Then sometimes it just has to stay out of the way to get the sound clear. And in that practice, something happens that's really magical with the breath Your voice becomes fantastic.
Yes.
It becomes a musical instrument that you know can project for miles if you have to. And has lots of flavors and possibilities and range. And so that there's a discovery process after about 20 minutes on the cork. 15 to 20 minutes on the cork.
It clicks in for people.
Well, it's not just that. It's clarity.
Yes.
It's the breath has, the chest has opened up completely, and the sound comes out of you like nobody's business. It's just,
yes.
Like, where did I get that voice? In fact, I should have done it before I talked to you today. I
really, oh, stop.
I should have, because my voice would be so much more musical, confident,
Sparky, a lot of our listeners are teachers. And I wonder, and a lot of them are training young people to give speeches. Mm. I wonder, what do you think? Is cork work, you know, just putting the 3/4 of a cork between the front and the bottom, or the top and the bottom teeth, do you think it would help young people as they're enunciating speeches?
First of all, I think it would be good to have a session first.
Yeah.
For teachers.
Yeah, right.
You can make a mistake and people...
Don't try this on your own.
Yeah. I mean, they can try it on their own, but they really need to know what they're doing.
Yeah.
With kids, I would use the cork the other way. I would not use it the big way. Their faces aren't big enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Use it the other way. And there are several concepts to get across that kids may or may not appreciate, but once uh-huh. they do, and if you have a warm-up that simply prepares the face and the body and the voice, like physical warm-ups and vocal warm-ups that are not on the cork.
Yeah.
Sliding the voice up and down a range, its range, and enhancing your range by repetition. I mean, there's a lot of preparation that goes into cork work. You can't, I don't think, helpfully just stick a cork in your mouth and do this.
Right.
You get the advantage of it. But when you're doing it properly, you really know when it has had its effect.
Yes.
And
yes.
You're wowed by your own voice, which is a nice feeling.
Hey, Sparky, let's go back to the Rialto in Venice. If you're directing this play, let's imagine you're directing this play. What would you want your audience to kind of be able to experience about the Rialto? What would they hear or see or smell that would really kind of place them in the Rialto in Venice for this play?
Ooh, I like the idea of smell.
Yeah, I do too.
I never thought of that, but
why has that not caught on with theater? It's like so ripe with possibilities.
Sometimes people do it, and I think this would be a good play to try that out. One play, Othello, that I did in a small theater, I had a small bridge built, an arch. With steps up both sides. And that set Venice. There was Venice. And it could be moved off.
Yeah.
You moved off in the dark, and then it was back, and then you knew you were on a canal.
Yeah.
That is enough to set the look of it, look of Venice, that is. And the Rialto is very much, or what would have been very much like the Pacino movie. I thought they really captured it in that movie. Very, very crowded. Business going on, people talking to each other, people eating, people selling. So you can picture that really easily. And if they're all in costume and they're all kind of standing around and posing and interacting in various ways.
Yes.
Venice isn't very big. You walk the sidewalks along many canals and bridges and walkways and airy piazzas, and at the end of the canal zone through town is the Rialto, crowded with open air markets and booths, storefronts, cafes, and everything's visible around. What the Rialto is about 3/4 of a square block that wraps around the end of the canal, and that's where the business of Merchant of Venice takes place. And you see it all, you smell it, you sense the presences of your neighbors, your business partners, your competitors.
Yeah.
I doubt whether the overclothed people you see in Venetian portraits were comfortable in their layers. I mean, I doubt it. Why did they dress like that? Yeah. Was it modesty, or was it to absorb your personal rivers of sweat? Because when I was there, it was July, a hot time, of course, but even right next to the canal, the Venetian summer is excruciatingly hot.
Really?
The Piazza in San Marco, you know, it's a beautiful place to be. But today, these giant ferry boats, like big buildings, cruise right by you. And it's not a very huge canal. It's really a very small river. So now, I guess they're not there. So this would be a great time to go, but nobody's going because it's all pretty much shut down to tourism.
Yeah.
But the atmosphere definitely is altered by seeing like a building move right past you. But that didn't used to be the case. It's all boats, and it's all boats everywhere. There are no cars anywhere. And the Piazza San Marco runs about the length of 3 football fields. And the Doge's palace is in Venice, and it has both a prison and torture chambers and an armory.
Wow.
And one thing I can tell you from the armor is that these were small people.
Really?
Smaller than teenagers of today. I'm 5 feet tall. Most of the armor would fit me.
No kidding.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it is.
So Venice is definitely a trading center, and you would have that commerce going on all the time. And it's interesting to me that Antonio knows all the details and the routes. I mean, Shylock knows the details and the routes of all of Antonio's business, his ships. He happens to know he's got a ship here, he's got a ship there, he's got lost that much, he's in danger of losing that much. He knows, Shylock.
And how does he know, Sparky?
How? Because he lives his life on the Rialto, where everybody finds out everything. You know, if you don't know, you can find out because somebody knows. So it's an open air market, essentially. Everything is visible, available. You can eat, you can meet friends. It's all public. You can see everybody. You can see if somebody turns their back and is like trying to ignore you. You could go into a storefront because they want privacy. You're going to know. And you might say to your neighbor, "Oh, why are they on it? What are they talking about? What are they talking about? Oh, they're talking about his daughter and this, that, and the other." So the sense of privacy and the sense of personal space is very different in Italy than it is with us.
It makes me think, Sparky, about, I think it's Act 1, Scene 4, when Antonio goes to Shylock and Shylock describes all of the rude things that Antonio has done to him. And it occurs to me after hearing your description of the Rialto that all of these things were not done in a closet. All of these things were done, if they were done on the Rialto, they were done in front of his whole city. Everyone's watching.
I think most of the life there is lived outdoors.
Yeah.
That's not behind closed doors. It's a whole different feel. No, wonderful thing I remember about Venice, which I would include in any play that I directed about Venice, is that people sing in their home, and you'll walk down, freely, and you'll just hear that. That's normal. And I had an Italian neighbor for years, lived next door to me, and he would do that. He would open his windows and I would hear him operatically singing.
No kidding.
No self-consciousness about it at all. And that's how it is there, is that people will burst out in an operatic cadenza. It's normal.
Wow.
You don't hear your neighbors do that, do you?
No, I don't.
They're playing their rock and roll too loud, but you don't hear this cutting loose with this glorious voice. So somebody's in the kitchen and that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you have to have that as part of the climate there.
Boy, that could add so much texture to a play, couldn't it? Just kind of hearing
the atmosphere, yeah.
Yeah.
So, hey, yeah.
I want to ask you, you said if I was going to direct a play, I would make sure that I included this. That brings me to a question that we talked about last week. And I think we've been going for an hour. I think this is kind of the question I know. It flies by. I'm telling you, Sparky, we always comment about how much it flies by.
Anything. Yeah.
We might have to bring you back, Sparky.
That's all we got to. We haven't done anything. Okay. Yes.
Last week we talked about how Sarah Jane and Heidi and I talked about how we would direct this play. So if we were directing the play, you know, through costuming and through staging and through acting, there'd be certain themes or maybe a single theme that we would like to bring forward. It seems to me the question of race and anti-Semitism has become such an important theme, especially since the Holocaust, in directing this play. But it also seems to me that the text that Shakespeare wrote seems to highlight, I don't know, a couple of different things. One of them is the mercantile flavor, the kind of like capitalistic relationships between all of the characters, how they're based on so strongly on money, on monetary relationships. The other one that seems to really shine in the text is this kind of debate between the law and the strictness of the law and grace, Christian grace in particular. My question for you is, if you were going to direct the play and you wanted to highlight a theme within the play, what theme would you highlight?
I would not highlight, maybe, but maybe that's not the right word, somehow bring forth the idea that Antonio and Shylock are almost two halves of a character coming from their very different places.
That is fascinating.
They wouldn't want me to say that. The characters. They wouldn't want me to point out that they have the one common issue in their lives, which is money, but they have a very, very different relationship to money. Mm. And yet, Shylock is castigated for usury or charging a fee, and Antonio is earning interest off of all these massive shipping deals. What is the difference? They seem to me a bit related, direct complements of each other, and their opposition makes it even more so.
Yeah.
Dramatically speaking, often a playwright will do that, find a counterpart to a character.
Yes.
I think they are natural counterparts, partly in being enemies. You don't have an enemy unless they reflect something that you hate.
Yes.
Usually it's something that you hate that's in yourself. And what's in Antonio's self is probably a non-recognition of how they are related in their pursuit of money and the past that's too far long ago to remember about Christianity that I mentioned to you before.
Yeah.
And
that is so interesting. I've never thought about that. It's sort of what you're saying is Antonio and Shylock have this kind of relationship like, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. I can't live without you.
Well, symbiotic is what you might call that. Business is like, you know, business, you need the other guy.
Yeah.
You don't have business. Yeah. You can't transact. But I am so naive about finance and mercenary concerns. So it all stands out to me. Mm. I can't invest my emotions in it the way these people do, but they are just beside themselves about money. Every character in the whole play, except maybe some of the minor characters, the playboys and so on.
Yes.
Are focused on money for one reason or another, and they talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
Shylock hardly says a single line that doesn't relate to money.
Right.
And Antonio, of course, is a worried man, and his essential goodness, which I feel is there, is obscured by his hatred of the Jew.
Yeah.
And his resentment of having to be beholden to him. So he can't be kind He is of that culture. They're used to spitting on Jews. That's what they do. And they're, even though he probably has a good heart, he's also angry.
Yeah.
A lot of the people are, especially the two central characters are.
Yeah.
Antonio has bound up his commitment, his monetary commitment, with this platonic love for Bassanio.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a simple shipping operation to him. It actually has to be designated, or at least part of it designated, for his friend. And that sort of platonic love affair looms as a factor. And Shylock sees revenge as a substitute for money, really, for interest. And he writes it almost as a joke into their contract. So he has a different relationship to money in this play, although he certainly wouldn't let it. I mean, he's as grasping as the next guy, and he's as, you know, full of faults as anybody in the play.
Yeah. Yeah. I just love that idea of kind of showing the mirrored nature of these two main characters, Shylock and the title character, the Merchant of Venice, Antonio. I really love that idea. Hey, Sparky, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. It was a real privilege to have you. Like I said, I'd really like to bring you back sometime. And I also just want to say, like, I get to host this show. The Play's the Thing, a play about, a podcast about Shakespeare. And honestly, you are more responsible than anyone in the world for my affection for Shakespeare and any sort of ability that I have with Shakespeare. And I just kind of want to publicly thank you for that. It's a really big deal to me. It's such an important part of my life. And you stoke that fire and kind of, in a way, helped me move from Shakespeare as sort of an academic subject to Shakespeare as this living, breathing force of vitality, the acted, real, like staged Shakespeare. I just want to thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. And I feel extremely honored that you even asked me to comment today. So there, I hope there's more to be said and that we can join each other again. This was delight. There's nothing I like better than talking about Shakespeare. I tend to get carried away.
Well, we're going to bring you back. We're going to give you more of the mic. So we'll bring you back. Hey, I just want to tell all of our listeners that you can find us on Facebook, on the Close Reads Facebook page. There you can post questions. We will be hosting questions and answers after Act 5 of The Merchant of Venice, and we'd love to hear from you. On behalf of the entire Circe Podcast Network, on behalf of Judith Sparky Roberts, I am Tim McIntosh. I want to thank you for listening and wish you happy reading.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.